Hi, everyone. I'm Rob Gray from Arizona State University. Welcome to the 17th episode of the Perception in Action podcast. In this episode, I want to discuss the topic of practice. How much does an athlete need to practice to become truly elite? What should it involve? Should it be fun? Can everyone become a great athlete if they just practice enough? In particular, in this episode, I want to focus on the most well-known theory in this area called deliberate practice, which has been popularized as the 10,000-hour rule. So let's get deliberate about practice. The essential question I want to tackle today is what is the relationship between performance level and the amount of practice? The dominant theory about this topic is the theory of deliberate practice proposed by Anders Ericsson from Florida State University in 1993. Now, to start off with, we need to be careful about what we're talking about, because when people use the term deliberate practice, they could actually be referring to one of three different things. First, deliberate practice is a specific type of practice Ericsson defined. One of his most fundamental ideas is that not all practice is created equal. If you're an athlete yourself, think about all possible things you could do while practicing. You could focus on maintaining your fitness level by running laps, you could be playing around in a pickup game with your teammates, or you could be trying to implement some new technique with the help of your coach. Deliberate practice is specifically focused on making improvements in performance, and is typically very effortful and often not that much fun. I can give you a personal example from running. Core exercises designed to improve the strength of your abs, lower back, etc. I know that these will help my running in the long run by allowing me to maintain correct form near the end of races, but I hate them. I would rather go out and do a 10-mile run at a moderately difficult pace, which, although being very enjoyable to me, would not result in a whole lot of improvement. That type of run really just serves to maintain my fitness level, which is not what deliberate practice is about. So in a nutshell, one thing that we mean by deliberate practice is a specific type of practice designed to improve performance. The second way the term deliberate practice is used is to refer to Ericsson's theory about the relationship between practice and performance, which I will get to in a second. Finally, when people talk about Ericsson's work, they are very likely to bring up the phrase the 10,000-hour rule. This quote-unquote rule was never actually proposed by Ericsson. It is an interpretation of his work by author Malcolm Gladwell in his very popular book called Outliers. This rule is essentially that 10,000 hours of deliberate practice represents some kind of magic barrier which separates non-elite performers, those below 10,000 hours accumulated practice, from elite performers, those with above 10,000 hours. This is an important distinction, because most people that say Ericsson's theory is completely wrong are actually talking about the 10,000-hour rule, which of course was not his idea. I will talk a little more about where Gladwell might have come up with this rule later. Before we get into talking about Ericsson's theory, let's look a little bit more at how practice is actually studied. This can be quite a challenge because in most cases, it would require using a technique called retrospective recall, in which an athlete is asked to remember what types of practice they did, for how long, and how they felt about it. This is obviously highly vulnerable to memory errors and biases. I can give you a related example from a study I did recently on young soccer players. As part of the study, we asked the parents of the kids to estimate how many hours they practiced each week. In most cases, these parents had visions of their child playing in the Premier League one day and thought we were some kind of scouts, so they often gave ridiculously high answers. You might think that the ability to study practice would be improved by all the fitness tracking technology that is available right now, from the GPS trackers many sports teams use to products like Fitbit. But remember, what we're talking about is deliberate practice here. It's not just counting the total number of hours an athlete is engaged in their sport. we need to determine what the purpose of the practice was and the amount of effort and enjoyment involved. Okay, let's now turn to the theory of deliberate practice. Erickson's idea was essentially that the level of performance an individual obtains is directly related to the amount of deliberate practice they have accumulated. There are basically three predictions that arise from this. First, there should be a monotonic relationship between the amount of deliberate practice and performance level. In other words, those that are at a higher level should have more practice hours than those at a lower level of competition. For the most part, this has been supported by research. For example, in Erickson's original study, which was conducted on violinists, the best players had accumulated roughly 7,500 hours of deliberate practice by the age of 18, good players had accumulated roughly 5,300 hours, while music teachers had roughly 3,500 hours. Similar results have been attained in sports. For example, in a study by Hodges and Starks in 1996, it was found that 10 years after they started playing their sport, Olympic wrestlers had accumulated roughly 6,000 hours, while club wrestlers had roughly only 3,500 hours. So it does indeed seem to be the case that great athletes practice more. A second prediction that comes from Erickson's theory is that the number of hours of practice per week should increase systematically as a function of the performer's age. This result is again well supported by research, as across several different domains, we see an increase from roughly 5 hours per week the first year after the start of their activity to roughly 20 hours per week at a point 10 years after they started playing. This has been shown for musicians, figure skaters, wrestlers, field hockey players, and soccer players. It is important to emphasize again that we are talking about deliberate practice here, activities specifically designed to improve performance. So drills designed for maintenance, competition, or play are not included in these numbers. The original studies in this area were pretty careful and rigorous about this criteria, while some recent ones have been a little more lax in ensuring it is deliberate practice that is being measured. But we will get to that in a second. One interesting question to ask at this point is why do expert athletes practice more? There are a few possible reasons we could consider. First, it is possible that they're not actually spending more total time on the practice field, it is just that a larger proportion of their time is spent trying to improve their performance rather than doing other things. A study by Soberlak and Cote published in the Journal of Applied Sports Psychology in 2003 provided evidence that seems to support this idea. In this study, they analyzed the practice habits of 4 20-year-old elite ice hockey players and quantified the number of hours spent in deliberate practice, play, competition, and practicing other sports. It is interesting to compare the breakdown of activities at two different age points. On the one hand, when they were 15 years old, these activities totaled roughly 700 hours, with about 25% of the time devoted to deliberate practice. On the other hand, when these players were 18 years old, they had a total of roughly 750 hours per year, but with nearly 60% of the time devoted to deliberate practice. So we can see not a huge increase in the total time spent practicing, but a big increase in the amount of deliberate practice. So it does seem to be true that elite athletes do spend a bigger proportion of their time trying to get better.
Yeah.
A second possible explanation for why elite athletes have more hours of deliberate practice is that they are more motivated. Engaging in deliberate practice requires a high degree of focus and effort, and often the rewards are not immediate. It is very likely that a young athlete could hit a plateau in their performance and become satisfied with their current level. This can be related back to the power law of practice I discussed in episode 8. After rapid initial gains in performance, the gains one gets from practicing fall off dramatically, what is often called the law of diminishing returns. It takes a special level of commitment and motivation to keep working hard at this point to reap those small but important gains in performance. A third and final reason, which is a major focus of Malcolm Gladwell's book, is opportunity. Often, skilled athletes are given more access to practice time and top-level coaches than lesser-skilled athletes, so a type of self-selection could be going on. In Outliers, Gladwell uses the Beatles as an example of this, suggesting that the fact that they had an abnormal opportunity to accumulate a large number of hours of playing live during their time in Hamburg was a major part of their success. Differences in opportunity to practice and improve can also be due to the rules and organizational structures imposed by sports leagues. A very famous example of this is the relative age effect in sports. Let me give you a personal example to illustrate this. When I was younger, my best friend and I both played what is called rep ice hockey. Rep, or representative teams, are a league above regular league play, as they involve traveling to play teams from further away and competing in a lot of tournaments. So there is a lot of competition to make these teams. Each age has a rep team of their own, with the qualification requirement being that you were born after January 1st in the designated year. Now let's compare me and my friend. My birthday is January 5th, while his is December 30th. So even though we are considered to be the same quote-unquote age and tried out for the same team, I am essentially a year older than he is. When we are talking about 9 or 10-year-old athletes, this can be a big difference, as a lot of physical development and growth can occur in 1 year. This is what produces the relative age effect. Athletes born closer to the start of the selection cutoff period, for example, the start of the calendar year in my example, are overrepresented on sports teams. For example, let's compare the months of February and November. Because February has fewer days in the month, there are about 2% fewer kids born in February as compared to November. Now, let's look at the distributions of births for kids that qualified for soccer tournaments in Europe in 2011. Roughly 500 were born in the month of February, and only about 150 born in the month of November. So what we see here is that the relatively older kids, those born earlier in the year, have a higher chance of making the team. You might be thinking, surely this effect must not matter as they get older and the physical differences get smaller. But again, the problem here is opportunity bias. In the years I did make my rep team, I practiced more, had access to better coaching, went to special training camps, and competed against higher level players. This gives a young athlete a distinct advantage that can feed forward throughout their career. With all that being said, I would be remiss if I didn't point out that the relative age effect is not as powerful and clear-cut as some would make it out to be. It does not seem to occur in all sports, is less of an issue for female athletes, and there does not seem to be strong support for the idea that it is solely due to the physical maturity differences of athletes at different relative ages. But it's still an issue that needs to be considered by sports governing bodies. If you're interested in this topic, I would recommend a review paper by Cobley and colleagues published in the journal Sports Medicine in 2009. Link in the show notes. Let's now turn to the final prediction of Erickson's theory, namely that practice designed to improve performance should be effortful and generally unenjoyable. Overall, this idea has not been well supported by research, as there are several types of practice that athletes rate both high in relevance to improvement and in enjoyment. For example, sports-specific games and working one-on-one with a coach generally fall within this category. Strength and flexibility training are really the only practice activities that fit well within Erickson's original idea. So it seems to be the case that some, but not all, deliberate practice activities are not enjoyable. Okay, now that we've covered all the predictions of deliberate practice theory, let's return to the 10,000-hour rule. Why has this idea captured the imagination of so many people, and where did it come from? Well, I think there are a couple of reasons it created such a stir and sold so many copies of Outliers. First, as I mentioned, it suggests there is a simple rule that we can use to define elite athletes. Above 10,000 hours, yes. Below 10,000 hours, no. Understanding why athletes do and do not succeed in the elite levels of sport is one of life's great mysteries. Just ask any NFL general manager that is preparing to decide the fate of their team's future when they pick the next draft pick. If there were some simple magical rule, that would be great. Mystery solved. The second reason that the 10,000-hour rule has garnered so much attention is essentially what we call a nurturistic account of skilled performance. That is, it is essentially saying that anyone can become a great athlete if they just put in enough deliberate practice hours. How great an athlete you are depends on what you do, has little influence from your genetics. To many, that idea is very appealing. I can do anything if I just work hard. While to others, this idea is not very appealing because it suggests we could have made a lot more of ourselves if we just tried harder. In a few weeks, I will devote an entire episode to the nature versus nurture topic when I try to address the question, are great athletes born or are they made? So now that we know why it sold so many copies, if it did not come from Erickson, where exactly did the 10,000-hour rule come from? As Gladwell presents it, we should be able to find some clear research support for this number. Quote from Gladwell, researchers have settled on what they believe is the magic number for true expertise, 10,000 hours. What is the source of this magic number? Well, sorry to underwhelm you, but there really isn't one. The most likely source is Erickson's original 1993 study, in which 10,000 hours was the average for the elite violin players in the study. But of course, as is the case with any average, there were several violinists in this group that had less than 10,000 hours and some that had more. So in reality, 10,000 hours was just a sexy number Gladwell latched onto to simplify the story and sell books, a practice that is very common in popular science writing. As you might expect, a rule this simple is not going to work for something as complex as elite sports performance. But remember to be careful not to throw out the deliberate practice theory baby with the 10,000-hour rule bathwater. Time now for another edition of Technically Challenged, in which I let you know about some of the tools I've been using in my research and teaching. Today I want to talk about the GazePoint GP3 eye tracker. The story here is very similar to when I talked about motion tracking systems back in episode 9. In that I have access to an expensive system, but was looking for something a bit more cost-effective we could use in my lab for other projects. In particular, I was looking for something I could use in conjunction with our flight simulators. As I will discuss in a future episode, John Alsop and I did a couple recent experiments in which we examined how pilots' gaze behavior breaks down under pressure. So I wanted to continue doing some of that work. I should say up front that measuring the gaze behavior of a pilot flying a simulator is one of the easiest eye tracking situations you can find, which is one of the reasons I do it.
So this equipment may not work for your particular purpose. But on to the nitty-gritty of the review. Again, you can find some pictures I took, plots of data and videos on the podcast website or Facebook page. Links in the show notes. The Gaze Point Eye Tracker is a system comprised of a small horizontal bar, 32 centimeters wide by 4.5 centimeters high. This goes below a computer monitor via a small tripod-type stand or a monitor mount, which you can buy as an extra. The tracker itself costs $495 US, while a package which includes the tracker and the Gaze Point analysis software costs $1,400 US, which is what I got. All of the software and hardware were easy to install. The eye tracker uses a simple and quick 9-point calibration. We tried this out on 3 different people, and after playing with the chair heights for each person a bit, we managed to get a good calibration for each. The reported accuracy is roughly 1 degree of visual angle with a 60 Hz update rate. For very fast eye movements, there is definitely a noticeable lag. The Gaze Point analysis software is quite nice and well designed. In particular, for our purposes, it was very easy to designate different areas of interest or AOIs. As you can see on the website or Facebook, we created separate AOIs for each cockpit instrument, which are presented on the screen in our simulator rather than using real physical instruments, and AOIs for different locations in the out-of-cockpit view. Once you've set these AOIs, you can start the program recording, reduce it, then activate any other program. In our case, this was the X-Plane Flight Simulator. It's also possible to control the Gaze Point software on another computer with a remote viewing module that costs an additional $495, but I did not try that out. To test the system, we had an experienced pilot fly an approach and landing. After stopping the recording, you have the option to export the data in several different formats, including a data summary, which shows the number of fixations and dwell time for each AOI, and a really nice video which shows the eye movement superimposed on the AOI image you created. In this video, dwell time is represented by the size of circles, which expand the longer you fixate. So it is a really effective way to illustrate how long people look at different locations. You can also get the raw data to look at transitions, calculate entropy, etc. I've included an example video and some data on the website. Obviously, it cannot be used for tracking eye movements when not looking at a screen, measuring really fast eye movements, or doing things that require a high degree of precision. But for the function of looking at eye movements in a flight simulator, this equipment seems to work very well and is a pretty good value for $1,400. In the future, I'll be talking about some of the results we are generating with this.
So to sum up what I talked about in today's episode, the general theory of deliberate practice seems to be a good one. The strong, positive relationship between the mount an athlete practices and the performance level they reach is a very consistent effect found in sports research. However, 2 problems can arise when we push this theory too far. First, there does not seem to be a magical number of hours that defines a cutoff between different levels of athletics. Sorry, folks. Life is just not that cut and dried. The number of hours of practice accumulated by great athletes varies substantially across and within sports. As I will discuss in future episodes, there has also been some pretty successful cases of transfer from one sport to another. In these cases, the athlete would have nowhere near close to 10,000 hours of deliberate practice in their new sport. The second problematic issue comes with the definition of deliberate practice as a type of practice. A common way to defend deliberate practice theory against those who critique it is to suggest that the critiquers do not actually measure deliberate practice. That is, high-quality practice focused on improvements in performance. Well, the problem here is that focused on improvement is such a loose term that this critique could almost always be brought up, making deliberate practice theory impossible to disprove. This relates back to the issue of definitions I talked about in episode 7. As the researchers in this area acknowledge, more work needs to be done on how specific types of practice are related to performance to determine if the construct of deliberate practice has any value. For a good discussion of the past and future of deliberate practice theory, I would recommend the review chapter by Paul Ford and colleagues published recently in the Routledge Handbook of Sports Expertise. In my next episode, I'm going to move away from talking about the number of hours of practice to talking about what we should be doing in those hours. In this future episode, I want to consider the topic of feedback. No, not that kind. What should we be telling an athlete about how well they're performing in practice, and how often should we be telling them? Would it help their performance if we showed them detailed feedback about their body movements or eye movements? How about if we gave them biofeedback from their brain signals? All this and more next time.
Remember, you can head to perceptionaction.com to find out everything about this podcast, including the show notes, some info about me, different ways you can listen, what's coming in future episodes, and ways to contact me. This is Rob Gray from ASU. Cheers for now.